Harper Audio presents The Achievement Habit. Stop wishing, start doing, and take command of your life by Bernard Roth. Performed by Sean Pratt. Introduction. Yellow-Eyed Cats. Paddy's idea wasn't the most daring in the class. When you first met him, you could tell he came from a military background. It was evident in his stance, stoic and somewhat intimidating. He went to boarding school in Northern Ireland from age 7 to 18, and then joined the Royal Marines, where he served for 10 years. Civilian life scared him, and after leaving the military, he quickly sought out the safety net of a job within a large corporation and a regimented schedule. A journalist, he moved around the world quite a bit, finding work at places like the BBC and CNBC. "I'm something of a company man," he would later tell me. When I met him, he was at Stanford University on a one-year fellowship for mid-career journalists. He was taking a class of mine, titled The Designer in Society, which encourages students to examine and take control of their lives. I've been a professor of engineering at Stanford for 52 years, and along the way, I've met too many engineers who once dreamed of starting a company of their own, and instead ended up working for large Silicon Valley companies and never taking that big step toward making their dreams a reality. Only a small percentage ever followed through on what they really wanted to do with their lives, and I hope to do something to change that. Having talent and good ideas is only part of the equation. The next step, the harder step, is the doing, taking the responsibility for designing success in your own life. In 1969, I created my Designer in Society class as a way to encourage students to think differently about how they achieve goals in their lives, to get them to stop thinking wistfully about possibilities and start actually doing. In developing the course, I employed principles that we now call design thinking, a big concept we'll get into a bit later, as well as a series of ideas and exercises I've found to be useful in assisting people to break through walls that are mostly of their own making. At the heart of the course is a self-selected term project. Students must either do something they have wanted to do but never done, or handle something that is a problem in their lives. I'm available to discuss their choices. I emphasize that it is their project, however, and that they are doing it for themselves, not for me. Ultimately, they decide which projects to work on. I don't decide whether they're good enough or big enough, and I don't grade on anything other than whether they do what they set out to do. If they finish, they pass. If they don't get credit. One of the most important lessons students take away from the class is to be honest with themselves. Really, deep down, honest. The more self-aware you can become, the happier you can be. By better understanding your motivations and identity, you can figure out how to design your life to be more satisfying and fulfilling. Paddy dug deep and came to the realization that although he had thrived in every institution he was part of, he had never been really happy. That was in part because he had a very conflicted relationship with authority and the large media organization he belonged to. He had sought it out because it was what he knew, yet he also resented and rebelled against it because he wanted something more personally satisfying. Once he realized and acknowledged this fact, he was able to use that knowledge. For his project, Paddy decided to produce his own radio show. When he compared his idea to others, he wasn't sure it stacked up very well. After all, we had students doing things that seemed, on the surface, much more exciting. One student was going to hurl himself out of an airplane. Creative, like building a rocket, or ambitious, students turning their bodies into machines to prepare for their first triathlons. For Paddy, a radio show was a major undertaking, and it took him a while to realize why he was so drawn to it. He had been a radio reporter, but never a producer. For the first time in his life, he would be making something from his own ideas, without oversight. It was a daring choice for him, akin to starting his own business. I now teach my class at one of the world's leading centers for innovation, the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford, commonly called the D School, where I am the academic director and one of the founders. It's gotten pretty famous. The Wall Street Journal called it the hottest graduate program, and we have more students signing up for our classes than we have seats for them. The D School is not linked to any particular department, but instead brings together students and faculty from many disciplines to create an environment that fosters creativity, innovation, and collaboration. What the D School does for students is open up their worlds, challenging their automatic thinking and assumptions, and showing them the vast multitude of possibilities around them. We write on whiteboards, post-it notes, and napkins. We try things. We fail. We try again. We fail better. We get things right in ways we might never have imagined, and we gain a better understanding about ourselves and others in the process. Many who have taken my course over the years credit it with helping them achieve significant personal and professional successes in their lives, and I have gone on to conduct workshops throughout the world based on the concepts taught in the class. It's empowering to realize you have more control than you ever knew over what you achieve in life. When you're not happy with an aspect of your life, you can change it. Really, you can. In my class, students have designed and built musical instruments, furniture, vehicles, and clothing. They've written books, poetry, and music. They've flown or jumped out of various aircraft, done stand-up comedy, and driven racing cars. They've learned how to cook, weld, tend bar, speak new languages, and save lives. They've repaired relationships with parents, siblings, and friends. They've run marathons, lost weight, and braved the wilderness. One of the most inspiring projects I watched unfold was that of a student named Joel, who reconciled with his father 2 months before his father died unexpectedly of an aortic aneurysm. 30 years later, I still feel tears of joy well up in my eyes whenever I run into Joel, his wife, or his children. The father of another student, Cindy, had always prohibited her from riding a motorcycle because he'd suffered a terrible accident when he was younger. Naturally, Cindy wanted to learn to ride one. She decided to buy a motorcycle and learn to drive it as her project. Several months after my class, Bill, one of her former drawing instructors, was standing in front of his design office in Palo Alto when she rode up on her motorcycle and asked if he would like to go for a ride. He got on, thinking she meant around the block. 45 minutes later, they arrived at the beach. That was 28 years ago. They now have 3 grown children together. Another woman in my class overcame her fear of water and learned to swim. I ran into her some months later, and she told me she was learning Italian, having felt empowered by her first endeavor in my class. A few years after that, she earned special training certificates that enabled her to change her career field, all thanks to the momentum and inspiration gained from developing her achievement habit. What she and other students demonstrate, not only in class but also in their lives after graduation, is that achievement can be learned. It is a muscle, and once you learn to flex it, there's no end to what you can accomplish in life. One of my favorite things to do with a group is to ask people to think about who stops them from accomplishing the things they want. It's always entertaining to listen to them explain how their parents, spouses, children, colleagues, bosses, you name it, prevent them from reaching their goals. These perceived obstacles are simply excuses. In almost every case, when you really dig down, it's you who are sabotaging yourself. Yes, sometimes there are real external obstacles, and most people don't realize that they have the power to overcome them. I once interviewed a job applicant who told me of her encounter with pirates when she and her boyfriend were sailing around the world. While the boat was anchored off the coast of Indonesia, she was sunbathing while he went into town. Suddenly, she heard a noise and saw heavily armed men boarding their boat. They pointed their guns at her and demanded money. Vulnerable and alone, with no money to give them, she kept her composure and was able to convince them that the powdered milk she had on board was a worthy replacement for cash. She appealed to their parental instincts, knowing milk was hard to come by, and that they probably desperately needed some for their children. They accepted the milk with gratitude and left her and the boat unharmed. After hearing her unique solution and admiring her clear-headedness, I hired her on the spot. That said, most of the time there are no pirates. We simply stop ourselves. To demonstrate this in my class, I ask for a volunteer to come to the front of the room. When he is standing in front of me, I hold out a water bottle, or other object, and say, "Please try to take it away from me." The volunteer will tug at the bottle, at first tentatively, because I'm older and look weaker, and then more forcefully when he realizes I have it firmly in my grasp. Eventually, I ask the student to stop trying. I then ask him to listen carefully to my next instruction. This time I say, "Please take the bottle from me." What follows is essentially the same action as before, with more force and maybe some twisting added. Sometimes he'll decide to change tactics and ask me to hand it over. I always refuse. Finally, I ask him, "Do you have a younger sibling or cousin?" I then ask the student to imagine that I am that person. We're both kids, and there are no parents around. Furthermore, I tell him to imagine the situation has gotten very annoying, and it's time for him to reclaim the bottle from me. Then I repeat the instruction, "Take the bottle from me." Participants who get what I'm driving at simply whisk the object out of my hand, leaving me no time to resist. I am overpowered by their intention to take the object. They have manifested a dynamic, elegant flow of intention to do, which is in sharp contrast to their previous static, tentative attempt at doing. Even better, in taking the object, they usually actually exert less force than they did before. I use this exercise to show that when you do, you are using power. When you try, you are using force. In life, if you want to get things done, it is much better to be powerful than to be forceful. Of course, the switch isn't so easy to make in real life. We've all had the experience of making up our minds to do something and then not doing it. New Year's resolutions, exercise, fidelity, deadlines, and work habits being just a few examples. In order to make the switch, we must understand our behavior. The classic model and popular wisdom says that we think things through first and then act on our thoughts. Interestingly, this does not hold up in clinical testing. By decoding local patterns of MRI signals in various brain regions, clinicians have shown that the brain can send motor signals for actions before the brain consciously forms the actual thoughts that account for the actions. You do what you do, and then you make up the reason for doing it. Most of our action is more the result of habit than reasoning. So that leads to a question. How do you bridge the gap between trying and doing, between talking about something and acting on it, and ultimately between failure and success? In this book, you'll find stories, advice, and exercises designed to help you create a different experience in your life, experience being the real teacher. When we established the D School at Stanford, we were determined to create experiences where students deal with real people, solve real problems, and make a difference. The results have been hugely gratifying. The students have gained a sense of purpose, mastery, and intrinsic motivation. A magical thing happens. The grade is no longer a useful or meaningful motivator. Intrinsic motivation has taken over, and the work is its own reward. By the end of the book, as a listener, you will understand the following: why trying is not good enough, and how it is very different from doing. Why excuses, even legitimate ones, are self-defeating. How to change your self-image into one of a doer and achiever, and why this is important. How subtle language changes can resolve existential dilemmas and also barriers to action. How to build resiliency by reinforcing what you do, your action, rather than what you accomplish, so you can easily recover from temporary setbacks. How to train yourself to ignore distractions that prevent you from achieving your goals. How to be open to learning from your own experience and that of others. The mind is trickier than we think, and is always working with our egos to sabotage our best intentions. That's the human condition. What we have going for us is that, if we choose to, we can be mindful about controlling our intentions to create habits that make our lives better. The ideas in this book are rooted in the design thinking tradition. Whereas others have applied its tenets in organizational innovation and change, I have chosen to focus on personal transformation and empowerment. Stanford's D-School is a pioneer in the design thinking movement, and as one of its founders, I have witnessed intense interest from all sectors of education, industry, and government. A wonderful book called The Adjusted American, a now somewhat outdated sociology text, attempts to explain the everyday neuroses of the average American. In it is a great story about the author's 3-year-old son. The boy had known only 2 cats, both Siamese, a breed with blue eyes. One day, a Persian cat appeared, and the boy squatted down on the sidewalk for a better look. Suddenly, he jumped up and ran into the house, shouting, "I saw a cat with yellow eyes, Mommy! A cat with yellow eyes!" Encountering a different breed of cat forever changed a small piece of this child's worldview. In the same way, we don't realize how many of our fixed views of the world are based on limited samples of reality. It's my hope that this book will bring yellow-eyed cats into your world. Yellow-eyed cats were brought into Patty's world. Until the class, he had not thought of himself as an innovator or creator. He was achieving in the more commonly accepted sense. That is, he had become an officer in the Marines, and he was doing well as a journalist. But he had not had any breakthrough personal achievements that were of his own making. He was just doing a good job, walking the paths that others had created. In my class, he learned not to recoil or procrastinate when a new idea arose, but to act. Just that small insight, which we call bias toward action, which we'll discuss later, has changed his worldview and pushed him down several roads in the last 2 years. He prototyped and produced several new products for the radio program Marketplace, published a book about economics titled Man vs. Markets, completed a previously abandoned novel, and started on the road to building his own business. Today, 3 years after leaving the D-School, Patty is making another gut-wrenching leap, from the safety of being an employee to the wide open space of being his own boss. Part of him is screaming in terror at this idea, and the part that channels what he learned in the class is telling him to go one small step at a time, to prototype his ideas, and to trust the design thinking process and himself. You can do the same thing. As you listen, you will find out how you can become more effective at solving problems, more focused on things that matter, and more satisfied with your life. This book will open your eyes to the power you have to change your life for the better. It will give you confidence to finally do things you have always wanted to do while ridding yourself of issues that stand in the way of your full potential. And the experience of taking control of your life will change your reality, making it possible to achieve almost anything you seriously want to do. A note about design thinking. So what is this design thinking stuff, anyway? Design thinking is a set of general practices a group of us has developed over the years that are effective in solving design challenges. A design challenge can apply to just about any kind of product or experience. It's not just about how to build a better mousetrap, though that's part of it. It's also about things that are not physical objects. How to improve the wait time at a popular amusement park. How to clean up a highway, how to more effectively get food to needy people, how to improve online dating, and so on. Design thinking is an amorphous concept that was given its name by David Kelly, another Stanford professor and co-founder of IDEO, when he was trying to explain that successful designers have a different mindset and approach from most people. We all adopted and adapted it at the D-School, and the idea took off like a shot. Suddenly, everyone was talking about this new concept, design thinking, something I'd been practicing for half a century without having a proper name for it. It's difficult to give an exact definition for design thinking, however, But because I'm one of its inventors, I can certainly give you an idea of the principles, which we'll get into throughout the book. 1. Empathize. This is where it starts. When you design, you're not primarily doing it for yourself. You're doing it with other people's needs and desires in mind. Whether you're designing a better roller coaster or a better hospital waiting room experience, the idea is to care about the user's experiences and figure out how to help. In this step, you're learning what the issues are. 2. Define the problem. Narrow down which problem you're going to solve or which question you're going to answer. 3. Ideate. That is, generate possible solutions using any means you like. Brainstorming, mind mapping, sketching on napkins, however you work best. 4. Prototype. Without going crazy to make anything perfect or even close to it, build your project in physical form or develop the plans for what you're going to enact. And finally, 5. Test and get feedback. Though I've just given you a list of principles, it rarely works that neatly or follows that specific order. You may get to step 4 and realize you need to go back to step 2 or repeat step 3 several times. That's built into the process. One of the other important concepts of design thinking is that failure can be a valuable part of the process. The only thing to fear is fear itself, said Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I say the only thing to fear is not learning from your mistakes. You can fail lots of times as long as you learn from these failures and figure a solution out in the end. We also focus on action, doing, rather than overthinking. In one of our classes titled Launchpad, professors lead you through starting your own company in 10 weeks, and by the end of that time, you'll be producing income. Or you can go to a conventional business school and spend a year plotting and planning before taking an actual step. Design thinking is very group-focused. We practice radical collaboration, both as professors and as students. What's different about my work and this book is that design thinking is normally applied outward, toward building solutions for other people's problems in a business or school setting. My special interest is in using it toward improving your own life and interpersonal relationships, designing the best version of yourself. While much of my teaching is rooted in this framework, not all of it is. There are many exercises throughout the book that you can try on for size. My view is that you take what's useful to you and spin it in whatever direction works. Sometimes I'll think someone has done an exercise wrong, only to find out that he got more out of it than I'd even anticipated. I'm a big fan of whatever works. It is in this spirit that I say, let's get started. Nothing is what you think it is. Chapter 1. How can I tell what I think till I see what I say? E.M. Forster. Your life has no meaning. I'm not telling you this to make you think about jumping off the nearest bridge. Instead, I mean it in a much more contemplative way. Let's first acknowledge that the meaning we find in people, objects, or our own circumstances is subjective. These things have no inherent meaning. Functional and dysfunctional behavior both result from choices people make based on meanings they create. This also means that we have the power to alter our perceptions, revising perceptions that bring us down and enhancing those that help us. Your outlook on life is deeply entwined in your propensity for success. Miserable blowhards can achieve, however, they still wind up miserable. That's not success. Success is doing what you love and being happy about it. To learn how to get a better handle on your perceptions, emotions, and behavior, it is useful to look at how you think. You give everything its meaning. Mike, a graduate student in my class at Stanford University, planned to design a musical instrument for that summer's Burning Man Festival as his project. The festival is held each year, the week before Labor Day, in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. Among the main attractions at Burning Man are massive art pieces, machines, and structures created by the participants. Mike got the idea of doing his project in my class because we both attend the festival. Mike wanted to construct a wearable pipe organ powered in a most unusual way. It would contain a small, fire-powered boiler that would then provide steam that could be directed through different pipes to produce music. The project seemed overly ambitious to me, yet I did not discourage Mike because he appeared highly motivated. Our agreement was that he could come to see me once a week and report on his progress. Things didn't go according to plan. At first, he visited me sporadically with excuses and little progress to show, and I soon tired of wasting time for both of us on these meetings. I told Mike to forget about the meetings unless he needed me for some reason. I would wait to see the final result. When the festival arrived, I went at a prearranged time to Mike's campsite at Burning Man. I brought along Adrian and Steve, two very capable engineers who were part of my Burning Man group and who had a keen interest in seeing the final product. Mike's presentation was a disaster. Clearly, he had not finished, and during his demonstration, the instrument worked badly or not at all. Mike was embarrassed, I was embarrassed, and Adrian and Steve were embarrassed for him. Had I been asked to evaluate Mike for a job at that moment, I would not have been able to recommend him in good conscience. Fast forward 3 years. I was again at Burning Man with Adrian and Steve, watching a dance performance by a group called the Flaming Lotus Girls, done in conjunction with an amazing animated sculpture called Serpent Mother, a 168-foot-long metallic sculpture of a skeletal serpent coiled around her egg. Propane fire ran down her spine from 41 flamethrowers that erupted from the top of her vertebra and shot flames 20 feet in the air. Her head and jaws were hydraulically operated. The three of us stood there, transfixed, as did thousands of other participants. Everyone agreed it was by far the most impressive project at the festival. We watched for a while and then wandered off. A few hours later, I returned by myself. By this time, the dancers were gone and the crowd had thinned. I was able to get up close to look at the details of Serpent Mother's construction. The mechanical engineer in me became curious about the joints connecting the movable head, and I asked one of the attendants about its structure. He told me he didn't know, but that guy over there holding the controller knows everything. I looked up, and there was Mike. I walked over to him, and without hesitation, we hugged and started to talk. It turned out he was very active in the Flaming Lotus Girls organization and their mission to bring more women into the maker culture that stands at the intersection of sculpture, kinetics, robotics, pyrotechnics, and electronic technology. They use a collaborative process that empowers participants to learn new skills and become active artists. Obviously, I was very impressed by what he had accomplished. On my 8-hour drive home after the festival, I had plenty of time to think about my experience. I remembered how embarrassed I had felt for Mike about his class project and thought how proud I was now of his new endeavor. Based on my previous experience, I didn't have a high opinion of his abilities. Yet, if anyone asked me now, I would not hesitate to give him a strong recommendation. Clearly, Mike was not who I thought he was, and his story certainly was much more nuanced and complex than I'd imagined. "Did I redeem myself?" he wrote to me afterward, and I had to laugh. Yes, he did. Getting to know someone can take somewhere around forever. People are always changing and evolving for both good and bad, and we are all capable of reinvention. I don't know what Mike had going on in his life during my class. My guess is that he was just a typical student who procrastinated and didn't place enough value on his schoolwork. At the time, that's all he was to me. I had written him off as a slacker based on that single impression. That was the meaning I had assigned to him. I had not stopped to consider that there might be greatness in him. The lesson to me was clear. Nothing is what you think it is. You give everything its meaning. My daughter has no meaning. In my class, I do an exercise in which I go around the room and ask participants to single out something in their lives, anything. Then I tell them to say that this thing has no meaning. I'm showing them that meaning isn't inherent in an object or person. So, for example, during my turn, I might say, my job has no meaning, and the next person might say that his wife has no meaning. This might be followed by others saying, the D school has no meaning, their shoes have no meaning, their shirt has no meaning, their hair has no meaning, their weight has no meaning, their bike has no meaning, their math ability has no meaning. From minutiae to things that seem of obvious high importance, they're all lumped into the same category. Things that have no intrinsic meaning. After that, the entire group starts mentioning items all at once so that no one is listening to one particular person and everyone is talking at the same time, each creating her own list of stuff that has no meaning in her life. It's a lot of noise and a lot of fun. The cacophony and pandemonium free people so they don't feel as awkward saying out loud that things they otherwise hold dear have no meaning. If you are alone, you can still do this exercise. Saying things aloud, even to yourself, can be very freeing. Your turn. Take a few deep breaths. Close your eyes for a few minutes. Then open them and move your attention around the room from one object to another. Each time you notice an object, say it has no meaning, as in, the chair has no meaning. Then think of people in your family and in your life and things you hold dear, such as your biggest accomplishments and most prized possessions. Name each, saying it has no meaning. When you're finished, sit quietly for a few minutes and then reflect on your experience. My colleague Sherry found it difficult to say that her daughter had no meaning. Of course her daughter has meaning. However, the meaning Sherry gives her daughter is not preordained. Some mothers abandon their daughters. Some mothers murder their daughters. Some disdain and deride them. And others cherish and support them. The variety of possible mother-daughter relationships and the meanings mothers attach to these relationships are endless. The point of the exercise is not to get the participants to change any of their relationships. Rather, it is to empower them with the realization that they have chosen the meanings they give to all of their relationships. As a result, participants often become more aware of how important a person or item is to them, as in the case of Sherry, who cherished her relationship with her daughter even more after this exercise. And they realize that they have the ability to change the meaning something has to them. For example, experiencing failure in an endeavor may initially be painful, but it is rarely catastrophic unless you give it that meaning. My colleague, Georges, was devastated when his son committed suicide after being jilted. The young lover took events that would probably be forgotten in short order and magnified them into literal life and death matters. It is easy to see the tragedy, both in the event itself and in the lack of perspective. Yet many of us lack this perspective, usually on a smaller scale, and it's hard to step back and see this in ourselves. Once you understand that you can choose what meaning and importance to place on something, you can also understand that it is you, not external circumstances, who determines the quality of your life. There is no permanent record. As is likely true for most people, there have been many incidents in my life about which I can now laugh, even though they seemed terrible at the time. The earliest I can remember was the day I came home for lunch in tears from my fourth grade class. I had been making noise in the stairwell, and a teacher, hearing me, told me that the offense would go on my permanent record card. I was devastated, believing that this record would follow me forever. My mother attempted to soothe me, telling me it was nothing to be concerned about, but I couldn't be convinced. Of course, years later, I figured out that there was no such thing as a permanent record card, and the bigger question is, even if there had been, would it have really made a difference in my life? A similar incident happened in graduate school. I was much older and should have been much wiser. Alas, I wasn't. I was studying for my PhD and took an advanced course titled Mathematical Methods in Physics from a young Nobel Prize winner. The final examination relied heavily on some things well known to physics majors that I had not heard of and that had never been mentioned in the class. I got an F. When I talked to the professor about it, he told me, "Well, you are an engineer. If I took a music course, I would expect to fail too." I didn't cry to my mother. Otherwise, the situation played out almost exactly as my fourth grade trauma had. I was miserable and went to see my thesis professor. He assured me that it was nothing to be concerned about. Still, it bothered me for a long time. Eventually, of course, I discovered that no one cared about the F grade on my transcript. Even if they did, would it really have made a meaningful difference in my life? Nope. I did take the next course in the sequence with another professor and earned an A+. And guess what? No one noticed that either. In life, typically, the only one keeping a scorecard of your successes and failures is you. And there are ample opportunities to learn the lessons you need to learn, even if you didn't get it right the first or fifth time. Learning from betrayal. During a workshop I ran in Bulgaria during the Cold War, I showed a videotape of some student robotics projects to the group. We broke for lunch, and when I asked for my tape back, I was told it had been locked away for safekeeping and that they were tracking down the person who had mistakenly left with the key. The story seemed a little odd to me. Later in the afternoon, I mentioned this to one of my friends who was also in the workshop. He told me, in confidence, that the delay was because a professor and his assistants, people I knew as friends, had taken my tape elsewhere to have it copied. Eventually, my tape was returned, and they stuck with their original story about the reason for the delay. What nerve! I was hurt and angry that they had betrayed me and violated our friendship. When I gave my second talk at the workshop, I spoke about scientific interchanges fostering friendship and trust. While doing this, I looked pointedly at the perpetrators. I was sure they understood that I knew what they had done and was slyly reprimanding them. Still, I wasn't satisfied. Upset, I went off into the woods to sulk by myself, thinking I would show them how wrong they were. I would leave early, skipping the gala closing banquet. As I walked in the woods, I kept festering. Eventually, my "nothing has any meaning" exercise came to mind. I ran through the events of the day in my head, listing off each item and repeating that it had no meaning. When I got to "this tape has no meaning," a light bulb came on in my head. It could not have been truer. There was absolutely nothing on that tape of any special value to me or to them. What were they planning to do with it? I still don't know. Give it to their intelligence agency? Show it to their students? Watch to get ideas for projects? I had already shown the tape. There was nothing private or groundbreaking on it. If they had asked, I would gladly have let them copy it, so what was the big deal? I had given the tape a meaning it did not really possess. They should have asked, and they didn't. Big deal. Why was I about to let this ruin my night? Once I cleared my head, I returned to the hotel and ended up having a wonderful time at the banquet that evening. This incident was a vivid reminder that while I cannot control what the outside world does, I can determine my own experience. Once you accept that you give everything in your life its meaning, you feel like the master of your life, not a powerless victim of circumstance and chance. Modified radical. When my friend Anne got breast cancer and underwent a mastectomy, she wrote "Modified Radical," a lengthy poem about her experience that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine and later incorporated into a booklet she titled "Modified Radical and Other Cancer Poems." The American Cancer Society distributed the booklet as a patient education tool, and it became a source of comfort and inspiration for many people. Anne received letters from readers telling her how much her poem had helped them. One very moving letter came from a surgeon telling her that even though he had performed many mastectomies and his wife had undergone one, he had not deeply grasped the psychological aspects of the experience until he read Anne's poems. That was when I first noticed that Anne has the knack of turning personal adversity into positive experiences for herself and those around her. A few years later, Julian, Anne's 59-year-old husband, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She was able to care for Julian at home for the first few years. Eventually, though, his condition became too much for her to handle, so she moved him to a residential care facility about 40 miles away. She visited him regularly, and I joined her once a month. We would pick Julian up at the facility and drive him to a nearby lakeside park. There, we would hold hands and walk slowly along the lake, singing old folk songs like "Oh, My Darling Clementine," and, in honor of Julian's Scottish origins, "The Bonnie Banks o' Loch Lomond." Finally, we would buy him an ice cream or something else for his still well-functioning sweet tooth. It was always a great time, full of warm feelings and fun, even on the days when it wasn't clear whether Julian recognized me. On the drive back home, I always felt glad to be alive. I left looking forward to my next visit. Anne chronicled how she and Julian continued to celebrate life in two books, Alzheimer's, A Love Story, and A Curious Kind of Widow, that describe how, after the initial shock of fear, anger, and dread, she decided they would go down the road together in a spirit of love. Her books were used by the Alzheimer's Association to give hope and guidance to many families. They also led to invitations to lecture to lay caregivers and medical professionals at workshops and conferences. While Julian was sick, I also had another friend with advanced Alzheimer's. He too had loving and concerned caregivers, but they were consumed by a sense of fear, tragedy, and loss, and he was ordered about like a child and kept under tight control. When I visited my friend, I always felt very uncomfortable for him and was glad to leave. There was no joy in that place. The contrast with Julian could not have been greater. Interestingly, pre-Alzheimer's, Julian and my other friend had been similar in almost every way, and their disease progression was essentially identical. Clearly, what made the difference was Anne's attitude. For me, it remains a strong reminder of how, once we understand we give everything in our life its meaning, we can begin to control what happens to us and even convert our own adversity into a gift to ourselves and our loved ones. The meaning of achievement. At the risk of sounding immodest, I've won a lot of awards. I have drawers filled with them. They're nice to receive, and sometimes the dinners are fun. However, the next morning when I wake up and look at them, the glass paperweight, the certificate, they don't really mean anything. So it is with many of the hallmarks of achievement, as people usually use the word. Getting on the honor roll, graduating from college, getting a high-paying job, getting a higher-paying job, being salesman of the month, getting the corner office, getting a company car, getting interviewed by the media, winning awards. This is what most people think of when they think of achievement. To me, all this misses the mark. Each of those things can be a genuine achievement, something that means something to you for more than a day, or each could just be a badge of importance that you use to show people that you're somebody. Do those things make you happy in and of themselves? I know mega millionaires who are miserable. They spend their money getting the fat sucked out of their love handles and hiring bodyguards because they're paranoid, maybe rightfully so, that people are out to get them. They're always concerned with outdoing themselves and making the next million and the next. And for what? Conversely, I know artists who barely scrape by yet are happy and fulfilled. Neither is a sure path to happiness or enlightenment. You can surely be rich and happy, but one doesn't necessarily follow the other. Achievement for achievement's sake, then, is pretty hollow. It's the endless pursuit of a carrot on a stick as you race around a track. For me, real achievement is traveling to a foreign country, learning some of the language, and finding my way around on my own. Real achievement is learning to be self-sufficient. Real achievement is making lifelong friends. In my mind, and for the purposes of this book, I define achievement as having a good life, getting the job of living done in a satisfying way that nurtures the life force within us and within those we associate with. It entails developing some self-mastery to handle the difficult aspects of our lives and relationships. It involves finding something to do with our lives that engages us and gives us positive feedback. If we're doing it right, life shouldn't be a debilitating struggle, even if at times it takes considerable effort. The familiar, unfamiliar. To forge a new attitude toward the events and relationships in your life, you must learn to look at them with a fresh perspective. It's a common practice during creativity seminars to give participants a bag full of materials and tools and then a problem to solve. The materials and tools are usually everyday items. Their nominal use is obvious to all. You are then to use those materials in whatever ways you want to solve the problem. However, there isn't usually an obvious connection between the items and your problem. For instance, maybe you have to figure out how to create a communication device using a box of Cheerios, a hammer, tape, cotton balls, a hairbrush, and a bag of marbles. Most people have a cognitive bias called functional fixedness that causes them to see objects only in their normal context. The use of the materials and tools in their ordinary way will generally lead to no workable solutions, or at the very most, mundane ones. The really exciting solutions come from overcoming functional fixedness and using these everyday items in new ways. To see the possibilities, it is helpful to take the viewpoint that nothing is what you think it is. You need to make the familiar unfamiliar. So, for example, a box of Cheerios is no longer only a breakfast cereal. It can be broken down into cardboard and wax paper. It is a source of biomass or a source of small chips and grains. It also can be made into a sludgy mixture. Similarly, a hammer is a weight, a source of metal and wood, and it can act as a mandrel, a seesaw, or a pendulum. Tape can be used to hold things together, and it also can be made into its own structural element in any desired shape. There are a number of creative ways you might use these items to fulfill the assignment. The same dynamic can be applied to ourselves. Just as things in the material world can be transformed from their common use into something different, so too can behavior and relationships. It's difficult at first to break through preconceived notions. However, once you do it, you'll find it opens the world up to you. Stop labeling things in their usual way. Mike is not a failure because his class project failed. You are not a loser because you lost your job. Make the familiar into the unfamiliar, and the result can be amazing and delightful, as opposed to dull, non-functional, and ordinary. My first experience with the power of changing a fixed perception came after a long day running an intensive creativity workshop. I was on a break, and I was completely brain dead. I was sitting by myself, relaxing in front of a large fountain. Suddenly, through my fog of fatigue, the fountain transformed from streams of water to countless particles bouncing off each other. It was an amazing experience. It was as if I was simply too tired to focus on the label, fountain. I was simply there, experiencing its component parts. If you stop labeling the world, your job, and your life, you may find that an amazing trajectory is there for the taking. Several of my favorite students never graduated. They were bright and capable, yet rather than play the game, they chose a different path. Their parents were probably not thrilled in the beginning. Yet, perhaps unsurprisingly, when I occasionally run into one of these dropouts, I almost always find that she has made good life choices that have made her happy, and often made the world better to boot. You can remove labels entirely. You can also relabel to great effect. Recent studies reinforce the idea that relabeling can change behavior. Experimenters have found statistical evidence that, for instance, If you ask people to be voters, you get more voter turnout than if you simply ask people to vote. Similarly, if you ask people not to be cheaters, there is less cheating than if you just ask people not to cheat. The inference is that people are more concerned with reinforcing their self-image than with their actions. Thus, to change behavior, you first change self-image. We all have ideas in our minds of what and who we are. We may have an accurate self-image, or it may be way off. Either way, it strongly colors how we respond to the world around us. In her book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, Carol Dweck writes, "For 20 years, my research has shown that the view you adopt for yourself profoundly affects the way you lead your life. It can determine whether you become the person you want to be and whether you accomplish the things you value." Occasionally, we have powerful, life-changing experiences. But most changes take place in small increments. Some unexpected positive or negative experience will change your self-image slightly. Through repeated incremental changes, the entire image is altered. Done the right way, this increases your sense of what you can accomplish. Psychologists say your self-efficacy is increased. This happened to Doug when he decided he could control his late-onset diabetes blood sugar problem by riding his bike 3 times a week from his home on the Stanford campus to the mountain community of Skylonda. The round trip is roughly 20 miles, with a change of elevation of about 1,500 feet. All went well in the beginning. Then he started to notice how much trash there was on the road. At first, he thought only, somebody should clean that up. Soon it dawned on him that somebody could be him. So he started to carry a plastic shopping bag with him, stopping periodically to pick up some cans and other trash. Slowly, this grew into a new persona for him. He eventually was hauling large amounts of trash on his bicycle, single-handedly keeping a good portion of the road trash-free. As Doug's activity became more known, he received increasing positive reinforcement from people living in the area. More and more drivers called out to him, some offering him money to reward his endeavor. He was a guest of honor at a community party. Stories were written in local newspapers, a movie was made about his road cleaning, and he received environmental awards from San Mateo County. He became a local celebrity. His self-image had altered considerably from the Doug who thought only, somebody should clean that up. He was now Environmental Doug, or as I lovingly dubbed him, Professor Poubelle, which is dustbin in French. The concept of self-efficacy has been used to deal with phobias and other limiting states, and of course, in most psychotherapy. Similar ideas have also been used in education and in creating pathways to successful living. In an ideal world, self-image would form the basis for much of what we do and do not do. In the real world, things are more complicated. Who controls your brain? We generally like to think we are in charge of our actions. Society has a stake in us believing that, or there would be no way to justify restraining and punishing people with antisocial behaviors. Nevertheless, we know that some of the things we do are not controlled consciously. These are known as reflexive or autonomous behaviors. It's easy to see these autonomous behaviors in other species. Some of these can be quite complex and are part of animals' DNA. For example, the South African weaver bird normally builds an intricate nest using specialized materials. Experimenters removed a pair of these birds from contact with building materials and from other members of their species for 5 generations. The birds were not able to build or even see traditional nests. And yet, when the 6th generation, still in isolation from its species, was given access to the traditional materials, it built a perfect nest. This may be an extreme example, yet it illustrates the point that even some complex behaviors may be reflexive and not quite under conscious control. You see this at work when physical danger and emotional threats trigger our fight or flight response. By the time the signals get to the parts of our brain that can reason about them, our emotional and reflexive brain centers have already armed our bodies, and we are in action. Although this quick gut-level response could be life-saving, it may not be the appropriate response to perceived emotional threats in a psychologically complex world. Not all issues can be satisfactorily resolved by following our first reactions, like when that jerk cuts you off by swerving into your lane at 90 miles an hour. What happens when someone does something aggressive on the highway? Well, most people respond in exactly the wrong way.